Well, those of you who are feeling a little nervous, there's absolutely no danger of me singing my way before the end of the evening. My wife has insisted. I was slightly regretting it, and I'm, you know, studying it, but there we are. Well, look, thank you, John and David, for what was sort of splendid and very kind tributes, which I really appreciate. I'm going to start off in a sort of slightly mischievous way, because I wanted to actually do a calculation. And that was that Mark is going to be in the job for 5 years. And I thought I might start with the National Risk Register and do a calculation of what he might have to look forward to. The National Risk Register, as you can see here, sets out some of the sort of main risks in terms of their likelihood and their impact. And to give you an idea, I hope you can read it, some of the ones I'm going to be covering are things like pandemic influenza, familiar to a number of people around here. It's also space weather, where you've got a nice picture of the sun, coastal flooding, and of course, terrorist-related activities. And I'm not actually going to be dealing with them. So one of the things, and as I develop some of these ideas, I shall be saying to Mark, well, you have every chance of appreciating the excitement of this and this and this. I've also taken a sort of 20-year time scale. And you may ask why I've taken a 20-year time scale. And the answer is we have every hope that High Speed 2 will be finished by then. those two timescales, Mark's duration in office is 5 years, and by the time the second phase of High Speed 2 is completed, will be the ones that actually bound my speech tonight. Let me go, first of all, to the emergencies. And first of all, as the slides show, we've had about six pandemics in 120 years, and so there's about a 65% chance in another before high speed rail is actually finished of having a pandemic. Now, obviously, these are highly variable, and as colleagues and I, Gordon Duff in particular, and Sally Davis, and I worked on the issue when we had the H1N1 swine flu, we were having to deal with something that was new. And I think that one of the issues that why this is on the risk register is this is way up in terms of its severity. And Mark, I haven't actually done a formal calculation of your chance of getting this in 5 years, but I will come back to that later. But this is actually, in a sense, symbolic, because we're looking not just at influenza, and indeed we're looking at a whole range of new diseases in animals and plants. And this is a very busy slide, taken from a variety of things, both in terms of animals and plants. And to show we're absolutely up to date, there's the ash disease, Calara fraxinia, which hit first time I've ever had a COBRA meeting, which actually was dealing with something on a time scale of probably about a decade. But these things were important and it got us working together. But I think one of the things that is quite clear, the way the world has changed, and that the upper right-hand little box indicates the sort of problem, is that within a very, very short time, emergence of a new disease is likely to be all around the world. And we saw that in the case of the swine flu, where within a month it was around in about 40 or 50 different countries. So these are some of the emerging risks that we're actually going to see. Now, the next one, which is something I'd never expected to deal with, which is on our risks register, is volcanoes. And here again, and I'll come back to this in a moment, we on our risk register are two sorts of interruptions of problems with volcanoes. One is the sort of thing that we saw a couple of years back, in which an eruption in Iceland produced large amounts of volcanic ash, which closed down our airlines for an embarrassingly long period of time. I'll come back to why that was a little bit later. But the one that is really worrying, and this actually is a genuine worry, is whether in fact we have an effusive eruption, could last 6-7 months at a stretch, and the sort of problems that would actually come from that are major problems of chronic health, major problems of disruption. Larky was occurred in the tail end of the 18th century, and actually, to cheer you up, Mark, there's a relatively small chance of you getting an effusive eruption in the next year or two. The sort of cartoon at the bottom shows the sort of problems we would actually get with an effusive eruption. The only thing I would say is that if it happens, I wish you well, because at least you can pronounce Larky, and it would be my expectation that if Mark has a volcanic eruption, he'll be able to pronounce it. I was never able to pronounce the, and refer to it as the volcano for much of my time when dealing with this as an issue. And the next one, major issue on our National Risk Register, is space weather. And I do remember mentioning this very early on after May 2010 to the Prime Minister, and he said, this is one of the things that really worried me. And he said, well, on Earth is space weather. And he now knows and is well briefed on the subject. But one of the issues that we actually have with space weather is, first of all, there's absolutely nothing we can do to control it. The sun is a force unto itself. Sunspot activity is operating on about an 11-year cycle, and we're moving towards a maximum. The worst event in terms that we can actually think about of a reasonable worst case was the so-called Carrington event of the 19th century, which involved a whole mix of space weather types. But it is actually really quite problematic. And the little box on the top points to an event in March 2012, when actually we had a very near miss. we had an event, and you can track it as you work through the seeing the, first of all, the sunspot activity, and then a coronal mass emission, and there a satellite monitoring can actually tell you whether it's actually hitting the Earth or not. And I think we were really quite lucky that that particular solar flare did not actually result in a direct hit on the Earth. There are some real problems with this, because one, you can't control it; two, you know it's happening; but three, there is a crucial piece of information which is to do with the disruption of our grid system, because it's to do with the magnetic orientation of the emission when it hits us. And whereas we have a 17-hour time window when we know this is heading towards us, and we can have a fairly good idea, well, Earth, the Earth, we have 40 minutes to know whether the polarity is one that is going to cause major problems to our grid and therefore involve shutdowns primarily in the Northern Hemisphere, or not. And I have to say, Mark, I wish you well in your briefing of the Prime Minister if there's a solar event and saying, we have a coronal mass emission moving towards you at us at the moment, Prime Minister. It'll hit in about 17 hours' time, and we may need to close down the national grid, or we may not. And he will ask you, how long have we got? And I will say, be able to tell you in 40 minutes. So I wish you well on that one. But that's the good news. And Mark, and to give you a summation of the probabilities that I've been shown here, you have a 10% chance only of going through your 5-year term without at least one of these happening. I wish you well. But that was the good news, Mark. Because if we go back to the National Risk Register and look at some of the ones that are actually there, many of the events that are characterized as risks are climate and weather related. And of course, climate is changing. And the ones that we've circled, they're drought, they're storms and gales, they're low temperature and heavy snow. We're looking at inland flooding and coastal flooding and so on. All of these are determined by the background climate, and all of these are therefore likely to be moving to the right on our risk register. These sort of little blocks on the side illustrate it. And I think the one of the problems that I faced taking over this job as Chief Scientific Advisor was actually to deal with the issues to do with scepticism, to do with the fact this is really happening. But I think as we move on, the evidence base is getting greater and greater. And just to give you one flavour, one of the things that I find really fairly definitive is this graph shows the temperature anomalies for three decades, from 55, 65, and 75. Give or take, red shows it's looking warmer than we might have expected from the historical average. So 55, and 75 on this. One of the things, you know, you can point out a little bit of warming occurring in the Arctic, very much predicted by climate models. Remember, this is data, not models. But if you actually then say, what about the last few years, that's what it looks like. And I think that is a dramatic illustration. And remember, this is data. These are data, not models. And that's the sort of issue that I think we have got to keep plugging away. And my speech will have some degree of repetition, that this has got to be taken extremely seriously. And it is a mix of modelling and data. And, of course, data takes a while to accumulate. But I think the variation between the three decades up to 75 and the years from 2006 to 2011, I think, show the enormous effect worldwide of what is occurring in terms of these temperature anomalies and, in short, global warming. Well, one of the other things that I have to do in terms of is to combat the remark that you hear all the time, these climate scientists would say this, wouldn't they? Because that way they retain their jobs, they get promotion, they get papers in Nature, they get research grants and so on. So one of the things that has been very extraordinarily useful is actually going to the business community, and some of you may have seen this graph, but this is an analysis done by Munich Re, the major insurance organization. They point out where disasters are coming from, natural catastrophes. And there's not a key on this slide, from which my apologies, but the red are essentially geophysical disasters, and the green, the blue, and the yellow are all to do with weather or climate-related disasters. And I think, albeit I wouldn't hang my hat statistically on the trend line, what is very clear is that since 1980, there has been a big increase in weather-related events. And I think that's backed up by almost a series of anecdotes. This is too busy a slide, but let's just take the last up here. There are state records in the USA, and looking at extremes of various types of weather parameters. And last year, there were 3,200 extremes, and that means since records began. Just in the top left. And, of course, we can pick out the sort of things that, for example, 2010 was the wettest year on record for the United States of America, and this last year has been the hottest. These extremes are coming up, and this is too complex a slide to take you through in any detail, but there's a generic issue here, which is that variability is going up. And variability is going up faster than the mean, and it's going up at double the speed of the mean. So to interpret that, what it's saying is that we're not just having an increase in temperature or an increase in precipitation, which we are, but in fact the variation around that is going up at double that pace. And this is some work that Hansen and his colleagues did publish last summer, and extraordinarily pertinent to the way we actually deal with risks and the problems, how we address those risks. Just to take a sort of parochial example, look at last year. It's quite a useful thing to say because, in fact, in terms of average rainfall, 2012 was an average year. It happened to be composed of 4 or 5 years of extraordinarily severe drought in the winter, followed by, as we all remember too, with some chagrin, some of the rainiest periods that we've ever had in the English summer and rainfall. And this gives a flavour of, this was taken in October, so the current month is October. The previous 7 months, you can see exceptionally high rainfall. The previous 12 months, somewhat, and the previous 24 months, fairly normal. And this is the sort of variation that we've got to expect, and it has consequences for how we deal with the threats to humanity and the UK as a subset. Now, we're not doing very well on this. Obviously, an understanding of human-induced climate change, and where are we in terms of international commitment? Well, there was an international commitment after the Copenhagen meeting to have a target of 2 degrees increase. There was various commitments, and this, again, slightly busy slide, points to the sort of trajectories that we may expect to allow us to get at least a 50% chance of stabilisation. Almost impossible, in my view. I think this is the changes in global emissions imply that if we stopped in 2016, there would still be an extremely low chance of actually meeting that 2-degree barrier. Now, I step out now a little bit out of my role as chief scientific advisor to sort of be almost a sort of commentator. I find it virtually impossible to imagine that there will be a dramatic decline in the use of fossil fuels. Just to give you a flavor, the taking the bottom left-hand picture, which actually I filched from the Financial Times, but NASA had actually done it. Why have I pointed out the Bakken Formation in North Dakota? Not the obvious. Well, that's actually the major source of shale oil production in the USA. This is a light thing, and the reason that that is showing up is that this is actually the flaming of waste shale gas. It is gas that is coming out from the recapture of oil, and as you can see, the light intensity is somewhat comparable to some of the sort of larger cities. And the reason why they're flaming that is actually the price of gas is not sufficient to make it economic to use. And in fact, this is a shale oil byproduct. But gas, though less than coal and oil, will actually produce greenhouse gases. And we also have some massive reserves of fossil fuels. The bottom right shows the world distribution of fossil fuels. Australia does rather well, but so does Russia and China and the USA and most of Europe and South Africa and Brazil. Again, and I move outside my domain as chief scientific advisor really to try to talk common sense, it is hard to imagine that these fossil fuel resources, and these are the new ones, and of course will not be used. The Arctic, ironically, becoming open up due to climate change and the melting of the Arctic ice sheets is likely to be a major new source. And the shale oil that is coming out of the USA is implying that the USA will be a bigger and more important producer of oil than Saudi Arabia over the next decade. Again, hard to see that a world where economic growth is problematic throughout, that we are going to see a dramatic decision not to use fossil fuels. Maybe it will. Now, the other issue is climate change itself. And I think one of the things that is sort of slightly hard to put over, though not to an audience like this, is, of course, that the time delays in the system imply that the greenhouse gases in the upper atmosphere at the moment will be determining the trajectory of climate and weather for about 20 years. And the variation here, the green part is the shading. The green part is arguably in the domain of the international community. The natural variation, whether it's driven by the chaotic dynamics or the uncertainty of the models, we can't do much about it except improve things, but we could change it. But even if we got a change in greenhouse gas emissions and their trajectory, the next 20 or 30 years would already be determined. And one of the things that I don't think is understood is the fact that as we increase those greenhouse gas emissions, as we fail to actually reduce them as we move through time, they are going to mean that in 2015, the weather will be determined then out for further 20 or 30 years. So the first half of the 21st century is pretty much being sewn up by the failure of the world community to actually cut back at the moment. And of course, there will be knock-on effects for later in the year. Now, one of the hopes for that is technology, geoengineering, discussion, a recent report by the Royal Society. But I think, and people say, well, there it is a possibility to actually think about geoengineering, and people have talked about using cloud ships, for example, to put droplets into the atmosphere and thus reduce incidents. And some very interesting analysis by the Met Office have pointed out that if you did that, even for a longish period, there would be a very quick reversion to the trajectories. So geoengineering of this sort is going to be a stopgap only. It might be a stopgap to enable the community to operate. It might actually save areas of the planet from decimation due to massive drought or significant heat waves. But it's an interim solution. It doesn't solve it. One that might arguably is, of course, carbon capture and storage. Less problematic. You are actually getting the carbon under the ground. Lots of concerns about it. And obviously, one of the things that we do need to be pondering about, one of the things that is central, is we need the technology to develop to reduce greenhouse gases, whether by, and I've just illustrated a set of these possibilities without particular emphasis. But one area that is not going to be helped by geoengineering and is not going to be helped much is actually acidification. ocean acidification is happening. Good tip, by the way, if you ever want to have a dramatic graph, is you have the x-axis done in millions of years. You can show things have got pretty bad in the last 100 years when you actually have that x-axis a million years. You get a fairly vertical fairly vertical line pretty much without trying. Not one of mine, actually. I cribbed it from somebody more acute than I. And so I've shown some of these issues, but there is a real problem here because the basic physics and chemistry of the interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean mean that ocean acidification is going to come. And that is going to have quite significant effects. Coral reefs, which are shown in white on the lower right-hand diagram, as we move through the predictions of ocean acidification from the end of the 19th century through to the end of the 21st, is showing the sort of expectation you would see. And of course, remember, it's a log scale, and so these sorts of changes are dramatic. And the problem is going to be for coral reefs and for coastal economies and for food, which takes me on to what David referred to. Let me pause here, because I think this is one of the most worrying things that we're facing in the 21st century. Just take these. I've put them all on one slide because many of you in this audience have heard me talk about these issues on previous occasions. But let me go quick. Population growth is startling. We are looking at a billion extra people by 2025, 500 million Africans, 500 million in Asia, Africa going up by 50%. We are looking at a proportion of the population that is actually living in cities, going up as we move through to about 65-70%, including the developing world. To put some flavour onto that, that's implying about 1,000 cities in Africa of the size of Edinburgh in 12 years' time. That, I think, is completely staggering, and I don't really know how we're going to do how that can be comprehended. The other things to do is to do, because I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of the risks and potential for natural disasters, is that the vulnerability. The world is getting older. And the bottom right-hand graph shows the increase in vulnerable people, age 65 and older, that is occurring both in the developed and the developing world. We start from a basis of quite severe poverty. A billion people not enough to eat, another billion people insufficient nutrition. We need to be thinking about that. And as they come out, these are the sort of demands that we're going to see for the three basic resources, food, water, and energy. And let me focus, first of all, on water. The current deficit on potable water, as we project out just 15 or 20 years, is about 40% of the current. As you can see in the top left-hand graph, the energy demand is soaring, almost entirely driven by the demand in the developing world. And despite real successes of our agricultural community and our agronomists and agricultural scientists, there is a real deficit in terms, we've got a growth rate in terms of our yields, but the sort of deficit that we're actually seeing there is implying we need a quantum change in the way in which we actually deliver productivity gains in agriculture. So those are the three. Let me first go a little bit to deal with water. I've focused on Africa as being a major issue with another 500 million people, total population in 13 years' time, 1.5 billion. And recent work by the British Geological Survey, funded by DFID, has pointed out that they're actually showing that there are really quite significant subsurface water deposits in Africa. To an extent, that's tremendously good news. But look at the left-hand graph, because actually there were very substantial subsurface water in India. And the red is essentially pointing to an overexploited aquifer. The green is essentially already saline. And you can see the difference between, and I would hasten to add that the picture of aquifer-driven agriculture is not from India, but from Saudi Arabia, but that we need to be thinking, and we don't have the technology or the management or an understanding of how we can actually sustainably manage these major aquifers, let alone rivers. So water management and this science to drive water management is essential. Going into food, part of the hope is that we will use biotechnology, not just GM, but I've chosen to illustrate the work that was done at Rothamsted, developing a pheromone, that is the alarm pheromone to aphids, using, not as some of the NGOs claimed, a cow gene, but actually using a gene from the peppermint plant. And actually, that was a real success story because there was a group got up that were, advertised via the internet for people to come and tear up this experimental study and saying this is threatening the earth. Interesting to see how, but actually what was tremendously pleasing to see was the way the scientists from Rothamsted engaged with the media and contradicted them. And actually, when we had feared about 20,000 demonstrators, nor the fact that we have real potential for thinking about engineering in the agricultural sense, and that there is a real role for engineering. We have the ability to use satellites, we have the ability to actually ask sensible questions like, do tractors really need to be that big? Can we do much more in terms of precision agriculture? So I think the answer to that is yes, we have got science that can do it, we can deliver things. But one of the problems we have is regulation. And here, regulation, frankly, is a nightmare. Let me just take a few of these points. The key point, which we've known since the 15th century from Paracelsus, is that risk is equal to hazard times exposure. Current legislation in the European Community, which has been proposed by a number of states since, is that we should actually move to a hazard-based approach. That is, if something is carcinogen or an endocrine disruptor, it should be banned, irrespective of the dosage that's going on. And the bottom right box points to the issue that if that happens, we're going to be losing pesticides that will likely lead to something like a 25 to 30% decline in certainly in most of Northern European agriculture. And obviously, the GM, we have been trying within Europe and failing to get registration through, and we're failing because of a political process, not a scientific process, to actually get regulations through that actually will allow certain GM crops to do it. And the one on the bottom shows the difference in appearance of a GM-based crop as in its a potato crop resistance to blight as opposed to the other ones. But I've said regulation is terrible, and let me just focus on it. What are the reasons why the volcanic ash produced such a problem? It was a fatuous regulation. The fatuous regulation was that if there was any ash present, you couldn't fly. Now, I see that I've got Colin Smith, Chief Technology Officer for Rolls-Royce and the thing, and Colin came in to point out this was not the most sensible regulation, with which I agreed. But that was the regulation. And there's a real danger of regulation where in ignorance, essentially going on and off. So one of the things that we need to be thinking about is, can we use science to better design regulation? Manifestly, in the case of volcanic ash, it's not what's the what the concentration is, let alone presence or absence, because it's the duration of a flight path through some accumulation of concentration. And I'm really worried about it. I'm worried that regulation in ignorance is going to improperly involve the precautionary principle. And there's evidence coming out of Europe the whole time that this is a political movement. One should be resisted. So, for example, shale gas, the exploration around Blackpool, producing earthquakes and whatever else, and bad practice. I think we need to be thinking about regulation. And I think the study that I asked the Royal Academy and the Royal Commission, Royal Society to do is the sort of way that we can actually deal with it. But it's not just in biology. One of the recent studies in my Foresight team is looking at regulation in computing, particularly high-speed computing, where you can get of the order of 250,000 transactions per second. The top left-hand slide is the fairly infamous flash crash, in which in a few minutes, give or take 10% of equity was wiped out of the value of the New York Stock Exchange. The bottom picture shows some trading in which you are getting feedbacks, loops, in which the thing is fundamentally destabilizing. You're seeing this sort of thing in engineering systems the whole time. What we asked about was what would be the regulations which would not interfere and would not make things worse. Interesting to say, the nodes of the top right-hand graph were six of the proposals made by the European Commission on the back of a European Parliament proposal, and the Foresight Group pointed out that three out of the six would actually make things significantly worse. Hopefully, that will be noted. Let me move on quickly, because I'm going to run out of time. I talked about disasters and resilience, and one of the good things in the positive message, first of all, is that disasters are going to happen and that it's the poorest of the poor. The top left comes from our Foresight report on migration and points to the fact that the poorest will be actually trapped. And if they're trapped, how can we actually deal with it? And there's some interesting things. The bottom right hand points to the fact that we are getting better and better at it, and our meteorological and weather forecasting is improving the whole time so that we can actually improve on disasters. And the bottom left points to work that the Met Office did. Again, in vulnerability, the urbanisation trends mean that we are vastly more vulnerable in our cities and coasts. And again, I've highlighted three points here, one from the BGS, one from the Ordnance Survey, and one from the Met Office, in which the ability to concentrate in very detailed way and on a very short, small spatial scale enables us to actually do it. The Met Office, I have to say, dismayed me about this, because the Met Office actually worked on Weymouth during the sailing events, came up with an absolutely brilliant prediction of what wave height and wind direction would be, how it would be varying over the time, and they shared it. We still won a lot of medals. Now, the final concern is something in The Economist recently, that somehow science and technology, we're slowing down, guys. We're not getting it. And, you know, you may remember the Economist cover saying, are we running out of innovation? Well, from my perspective, absolutely not. The amount of work that is going on, and I've just highlighted a few of these things very briefly to point out some of the changes. In the privileged position I have, I do get a chance to go around our universities and laboratories to understand how much is happening out there. And it's fantastic. So actually, no, I don't think we're running out of innovation. And finally, and I do mean finally, what are the challenges going a little bit further? I'm going to highlight just these. Population is now at a tipping point. If we are currently at a stage where if we see trends of declines in female fertility, with prosperity, with better education, with the availability of contraception, we have a chance of stabilizing population around something feasible, somewhere between 9 and 10 billion. If we don't, it could take off. And I just don't believe that is feasible. So I think the tipping point on population is of profound importance and much neglected. The second one you'd expect me to save because of the preamble, I think we are at tipping points in the climate system. And just to give you a flavour of it, what we need by 2050 is much more food, much more water, much more energy, and a lot less greenhouse gas emissions. So thank you for your attention.